Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
One of my favorite scenes in the movie The Social Network is when the Winklevoss twins are talking to a friend about Mark Zuckerberg, who had run off with their idea for the Facebook. In the scene, the friend comments that he would love to hire the Sopranos to, quote, beat the shit out of him with a hammer. The him, of course, being Mark Zuckerberg. To which Tyler Winklevoss responds, we can do it ourselves. I'm 6'5", 220, and there's two of me. Yes, my guest this week is actually two guests, and you guessed it, it's Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss. They're going to talk to me today about that movie, The Social Network, what it's like to see yourselves as a character on The Simpsons, of course, those days back at Harvard with Mark Zuckerberg, rowing on an Olympic team, and much, much more. But before we get to all that, we're going to start our conversation with the main passion of these two right now, which is actually Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. So I'd like to welcome them both to the show. So thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today. I figure we'll jump right in and talk about something that I know that you're both incredibly interested in, something that I'm fascinated with, which is the current state of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and all that stuff. Can you give us like a little bit of a lay of the land of where things are right now? Because I feel like I can't keep up.
Yeah, sometimes we feel the same way. This is Cameron. the last couple of months have been pretty exciting time for the space of cryptocurrency or digital assets, namely Bitcoin, obviously being the oldest one that first was launched in 2009, but has really started to hit more and more mainstream adoption and certainly been covered in the media quite a bit over the past couple of years. And then Ether is a newer entrant into the space. If Bitcoin is sort of a digital gold, Ether is sort of a digital oil that kind of is creating a network of smart contracts. And both of these two together have seen huge growth over the past couple of months and a lot of coverage in the media.
So how did you both get into digital currencies? Was it just like you were walking down the street one day and you thought, hey, that could be something that's interesting? What was the premise that got you both into it?
So this is Tyler. It was almost as serendipitous as that. We were actually on vacation in the summer of 2012 in Ibiza, of all places, and a stranger came up to us who actually had some mutual friends in common. He recognized us and he said, oh, do you know so-and-so? You know, I know them. And they sort of knew we had that friend in common. We started talking and he said, hey, have you ever thought of digital currency and Bitcoin, stuff like that? And we had just finished, retired from our athletic career of 15 years, and we were just getting back into the entrepreneur startup game. So we hadn't. And next thing you know, we were back in the States in August and talking with a bunch of Bitcoiners. And so we understood the pain point immediately because we actually, our accommodation overseas, we had to pay for it. Apparently not enough money was wired at the moment. And the pain point of getting money from the States to Ibiza when you're there for only a week was obviously, you know, clearly evident to us at the time. And when we started digging into it, we realized, hey, you know, like, it's kind of embarrassing. We just accept money as it is because it's something that's familiar. It's something we grew up with. And we're both economics majors at Harvard, and we'd studied a fair amount of, you know, economics and knew a little bit about money, but and the history of money. But when you stop to think about it, we recognize that payments really don't work in the modern information age the way they should. Money doesn't really work the way it should. You know, if money is just information at the end of the day, and we can send an email, you know, for pretty much free and instant anytime, then why shouldn't our money work the way our email does and work for the internet? And you started looking deeper into this idea that, well, the forms of money that we're used to prior to digital currency were all invented before the internet itself. So they never contemplated working on the internet. So credit cards, ACH, Fedwire, it's a square peg in a round hole trying to make them work on the internet. And then Bitcoin comes along and you recognize it's actually built by the same type of engineers and computer scientists who built the internet itself. And that's why it works so well. And so I think that when we started digging there, we kind of recognized, whoa, there's a lot of potential here.
So one of the things that I find there's two things I find really confusing, and I'm fascinated by the whole topic and everything, is first of all, it seems like every single day there's like a new cryptocurrency, and I'm like, well, which one am I supposed to pay attention to? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I wrote a book called American Kingpin. It was about the Silk Road and the Dread Pirate Roberts, and of course, the Silk Road drug website where you could buy and sell anything using Bitcoin. And one of the people who read an early draft of the book was my mother-in-law, and she couldn't understand Bitcoin for the life of her. I mean, I remember my wife and I were, you know, thought we'd explained it to her about how, you know, you exchange your money, your dollars for Bitcoin, this, that, and the other. And then she finally came in the house and she said, okay, I totally get it. But what does a Bitcoin actually look like? And we just were like, how can you explain to most people? I mean, I do technology stuff for a living and it's hard for me to get my head around some of this stuff. Like, how do you explain these cryptocurrencies to most people if you want it to become a standard form of currency across the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's challenging, right? There's so many different facets. This is Cameron here. When I first got back to the States from the trip in Ibiza that Tyler's referencing, I sat down and started digging into Bitcoin and reading about it. And I said, Tyler, you got to come over here. This is either like the next biggest thing and the implications are enormous or complete bullshit. It's a totally binary outcome. But basically, we started digging into it and we started buying it and feeling it. You know, obviously, there's nothing to feel in Bitcoin because it doesn't actually exist in the physical form. But there's so many different facets of these things. But I think what helps us in understanding it is making a real world analog. So Bitcoin, in our view, is a digital gold. And when you start thinking of gold and why people buy gold, and what they like about gold, they like the scarcity, they like the portability, the fungibility, the divisibility, and so on. And there's about 9 key characteristics of gold, which is generally used as a hedge against inflation and disaster insurance and just an alternative to the US dollar. And if you line Bitcoin up next to gold, it actually equals or betters gold in all of those 9 categories. It's more divisible than gold. It's clearly more portable than gold. You can move it. We can basically send, it's like sending information. We can send it like an email all around the world very easily. So that helps me at least conceptualize like what is Bitcoin doing? How do I sort of build a mental framework for this type of asset?
And that's sort of the larger question of what is money? Is it shells? Is it a piece of paper? Is it a precious metal? Or is it just information? Or is it a system that everyone buys into that gives it value? Obviously, we have U.S. dollars, but I think what you're talking about is a little bit more of like the usability of it.
Understandability of it too. A dollar bill. I understand that I can take this thing and I can hand it to someone. And I guess the question is, the larger question is, if you know, for it to become more than just a bunch of people trading Bitcoins on the internet, for it to actually become a thing that my mother-in-law uses or that my dad uses or whatever. What needs to happen for that to happen?
Right. So the way to understand Bitcoin, as Cameron said, is if you can understand why gold would be important to have in your investment portfolio or some other precious metal, that is, those same reasons are why Bitcoin has a place there, or how to understand Bitcoin. All of our money is digital. Even most people don't carry around cash or pay people in cash. they use either some sort of app like Venmo or PayPal, or they actually wire ACH. The majority of money moves in a digital manner, and most people accept when they go to their bank account that they pull up their online banking and they see a ledger entry or a number. They don't actually look at a vault with dollar bills of their wealth. So I think people expect Bitcoin to be somehow different, or they already accept the fact that money in briefcases is in the movies, and that's like a 100-year-old thing, and we're already in a digital world with money. If you want to dive deep into like the guts of Bitcoin, how it works, well, most people don't understand how the internet works. They don't understand what the protocols that their email works on, like SMTP or IMAP, but it does work, and it's one of those things that's easier to experience than it is to necessarily explain. So we can sort of go down the crypto rabbit hole of why it works, but I think that your mother-in-law is probably waiting for the day when she's actually using it without even knowing she's using it. So that's sort of like the layer, application layer, to be developed on top of it. Just like the internet was a pretty sort of janky, kludgy experience in the early 90s, only really technological experts were using the internet or even email. And then when things like Gmail came along, or even AOL before that, it sort of put the skin over it that made it easy and usable. And that's definitely something that Bitcoin and all cryptocurrency, even Ethereum, has its work cut out. But I think that before you get the Googles and the Facebooks of the sort of the native things that couldn't happen without the internet, you first need, you need to run like broadband connections and routers and all of the sort of infrastructure. And that's what Gemini is. That's the digital asset exchange that Cameron and I have been building, is to really build the infrastructure, sort of the gateway or on-ramps into this world in a user-friendly way for both individuals and institutions. And then once we get the on-ramps easy to use, then it becomes easier to, once you're in that world, to start to use the application there. But there isn't really a mainstream use case or application in any of these cryptocurrencies yet that I would say to your mother-in-law that, hey, you need to use this, you can't live without it. But yeah, all of the stage and all the groundwork and building blocks are being set and laid right now. So I think in the next 5 years, we're going to see an explosion of what people like to call as like a native Bitcoin app, a native Ethereum app, something that couldn't be contemplated or actually couldn't work outside of these technologies.
And just to further add to that point, if you talk to the younger folks, they don't want any hardware money. They don't think in the physical. They think, if you think of the way we consume music growing up as physical CDs or records, and it's now all MP3s, and then it went even one step further, and it's literally streaming from the cloud. The younger generation doesn't really think about physical money, and quite frankly, they don't have an issue wrapping their head around.
They've been living in digital, whether it's Nintendo points or World of Warcraft points. They live with digital currency. Maybe they're centralized digital currency is different than an actual decentralized crypto. But the idea of physical money and cash, that'll be like owning vinyl records one day. And we'll probably be telling our grandkids. They'll be like, granddad, what was that weird thing that those pieces of plastic and paper that you carried around, what was that all about? Just like probably driving a car will be a skill that
you relearn
your kids won't even be learning. So I think that it's really funny when you talk to millennials about this stuff. They totally get it. They track immediately. They're actually more comfortable with it than our generation. And when you talk to older folks, as you get older, you get more sort of calcified, crystallized in your ways, and you're just less open to the things that are new.
So, okay, last question on Bitcoin, and then we'll move along to some other topics. I own one Bitcoin. I'm very proud of myself. Should I sell it now, or should I wait? Do you think it's going to eventually be worth tens of thousands of dollars, a single Bitcoin, or where do you think it's going?
This is the million-dollar question. I will say that we are not qualified to give investment advice. with that said, we definitely get asked this question a lot, and I generally the way I kind of like to think about this question is, it really depends on your time horizon. If you are a buy and hold type person who believes that, you know, you're going to hold that Bitcoin and you have no problem holding it for the next 10 years, I think that, you know, we are just at the first inning of this entire space. It is a thing. It's not an if, it's a when, and it's growing rapidly. I think in the last year, we've seen many tens of billions of dollars of market cap being added to the ecosystem as a whole. So we think, you know, we're obviously very long-term bulls on the entire sector. So if your time horizon is long enough, it's probably a good idea to hold.
But our whole thesis is that Bitcoin is gold 2.0. It's better at being gold than gold. And so if that's the case, look at the market cap of Bitcoin and look at the market cap of gold. Bitcoin's about a $50 billion market cap, and gold is at least in the the trillions. So there's, if our thesis is correct, then there's still a huge appreciation to be had. If something comes along and is a better, you know, defeats Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency, or people say, you know, don't actually buy into that thesis long term, then it can go to zero. So you can argue very credibly that Bitcoin's very undervalued right now, but at the same time, there is definitely all sorts of risks that are there, and that's sort of like every individual's decision that we make. But like Cameron said, we're long term bulls and holders.
Okay, good advice, even though it's not investment advice. okay, so switching gears a little bit, you mentioned earlier that you both retired from your was it rowing career? Is that right?
That's right.
Do you both? So I'm a twin. I have a twin sister, and we couldn't literally be more polar opposite human beings. and it seems like everything you guys do together. Is that the case? I mean, are you both interested in Bitcoin simultaneously, or is it that you bring it to each other? Are you both, do you both decide at the same time, like, let's quit rowing? Does one of you say, hey, I want to keep rowing for a couple more years? Like, how do you guys make these decisions together?
It's a great question. I think we've always been a really good team. Even as kids growing up, we used to build Legos together and have different strengths and different weaknesses. We always played sports together. We had our larger group of friends was the same, but sometimes we'd have slightly different groups of friends. And I think that we've just really enjoyed being a team as athletes. So I think that we kind of got into the rowing thing together, and we'd spent 15 years in the sport. We rowed in the 2008 Olympics as the men's U.S. pair, came in sixth place. And so I think a lot of it was doing it together as a team. So it kind of made sense that we bowed out at the same time, although there wasn't some hardline rule that, you know, we had to. We didn't make that, agreement with each other. And I think
Like other things too, like entrepreneurial pursuits and things like that, do you always decide to do these things together as a team, or are there times that you say, oh, I'm going to go off and do this on my own or something like that?
Well, we definitely divide and conquer, and we definitely have different opinions. We don't always ratify each other just because we're twins. Cameron's actually a lefty and I'm a righty, so we're mirror image twins. So I guess technically we use different sides of our brains. I think overall our goals are the same, but definitely there are certain, even day-to-day things in building Gemini or certain investments where one might be more excited than the other, or even when we're listening to the radio, I might say, oh, that song's really annoying. Karen's like, oh, I kind of like it. So I think that's why we were able to be a team for a long time, and even to this day, is because we don't always agree. I think we agree on the big things and the core values, but overall, we're very different people. I know that sounds weird because on paper we're like identical, but our friends will sort of say, like, you guys are so different, and we certainly look at each other and we don't see the same person. But I get how, like, the outside perception is that, like, you guys do everything together.
And I think a lot of it, what's helped us probably for the past 35 years, is that we don't really compete against each other. We really compete together, and we pick goals and pick things that we we really want to try and hit or achieve, and then kind of work together. And in rowing, let's say Tyler pulled a PR on what's called an ergometer, the erg test. That's like the rowing machine. The rowing machine.
I don't speak rowing.
Yeah, sorry. I'll break it down real quick. So basically, you row, but in the winter and off season, you train on what's called ergometers or erg machines, or short. You know, sometimes just we call it the erg for short.
Or it's a rowing machine you see in the gym.
Exactly. It's basically like a medieval torture device. Incredibly painful, but it gets you really fit. And you do tests on those machines to sort of test your limits. And if one of us, you know, hits PR or breaks a certain time, you know, I think the other is sort of saying, oh, well, I guess I can do that too. And we kind
of... I sort of say like, well, if Cameron did that, well, we're identical twins, then I can do that too. Cool. Like, and I'm like his biggest cheerleader because I sort of live vicariously through that effort. But another funny sort of fact or tidbit is that, so we both played classical piano for 12 years as kids into the end of high school. And then we sort of stopped playing musical instruments for a while. And then Cameron got into the guitar, and I've more recently got back into piano. And he has a huge passion for guitar and shredding and Van Halen and this kind of stuff, and, you know, whammy bars and everything. I don't quite share that passion. I think, Cameron, you had a guitar lesson yesterday with a teacher over Skype, and it was like a whammy bar expert. So Cameron's gone like really like deep into guitar and all of that stuff. And I don't quite share that energy for that, but I do feel it a lot more for piano. I'd prefer to you know, work on my piano skills, and maybe I'll get to guitar one day. But you know, overall, we're very passionate about music, but we've taken slightly different instruments in paths to get better at. And so I think that's kind of like, I think that very much sums up how we're very alike, but also different at the same time.
You guys should start a piano rock guitar band, the Winklevoss brothers.
That, as soon as, you know, we're done with this crypto stuff and Bitcoin, that'll be our next chapter, I'm sure.
Did you guys always get along as kids, or did you fight?
We always did. Every sibling relationship has its moments, and you sort of like work. But like for us, it was like, you know, a disagreement for a couple of minutes, or, you know, at most. And I think that was the key thing, is that we never thought anything was so worth it to hold a grudge or be against each other for like a week at a time or even a day. And so I think it's a skill that you have to learn and work on. We definitely today we are a lot we sort of roll with things even much better than we did 5 years ago, and even before that. So it's something that it would be like really weird and hard to believe if two people who spent as much time in as high pressure environments with as much as high goals as we did didn't every once in a while get at each other's, you know, throats or on each other's nerves. But the key is to recognize that there's no fight or there's no issue that's worth fighting for. There's no hill that's worth, you know, dying on so much that you no longer work together or forget the fact that you guys are each other's best friends, that you share like the same, you know, genetic code, and nobody has your back more than that other person. And that's a huge asset, that sort of knowing that your interests are being watched out as much by you as by someone else is a great asset, whether you're going into sports or business. And I try and tell this to other siblings or other families. It's like, it's something you have if you cultivate and grow. It's not going to be easy day one, like, oh, we just came out of the womb and we were like awesome, you know, well-oiled teammates. We had to work at that. And I think, you know, everyone should to some degree, because the other thing is really, it's sad. You know, you see these destructive competitions and rivalries between siblings or family members, and it's like, over what? Like, it's not even important, and life's too short. If you guys work together, you would push each other so much further forward, and it would be a lot of fun at the same time. And so, you know, we've always done that, and it's worked out pretty well so far.
So you guys are both, you know, a part of pop culture. You, of course, were in the Social Network movie, or well, there was a version of you played in the Social Network movie. You guys were on The Simpsons. What does it feel like to see that, or to be part of that, to see a version of yourself on The Simpsons or something like that?
It's definitely a surreal feeling. I mean, I think when we first, I'd say probably 2 or 3 years into the whole Facebook lawsuit, that's when the media started paying attention. And like overnight, it just changed and it became a household interest, quite frankly, global for that matter. So there's definitely surreal aspects of it. But we try to have fun and roll with it. You know, there's a lot of noise out there at times, but we've just sort of kept our heads down. And we were rowing the whole time through that on the national team. So we were sort of living a very monastic lifestyle, doing this thing. And there was this huge sort of parallel universe of a story and interest and then the movie. So it was kind of interesting. There's quite a disconnected time from reality and what our day-to-day was and sort of how this whole media story was unfolding. And I think probably what partly...
We couldn't let it change our lives, because if we knew what we had to do as athletes, and that was get up at 6 a.m, train for a couple of hours, eat, sleep, get up, train a couple more hours, eat, and then go to bed before 10 o'clock and repeat that 6 days a week.
50 weeks a year.
So we couldn't be running red carpets and living that whole lifestyle to a certain extent. So we had to actively make sure it didn't change anything for us. And in terms of, so like Cameron said, it's kind of like this parallel universe of what our lives actually really were at that time and what was this narrative going on in pop culture. And there was like absolutely huge disconnect. I mean, we were devoting ourselves to moving a boat, you know, a little bit further each stroke. You know, that was our whole, you know, life. And the whole world was talking about something that happened over the span of 3 months, like 5 years before at that time. So it was kind of like this really interesting irony. But at the same time, it's probably easier for an outsider to perceive what it is than for us. You know, when you're in it, when you're in the moment, it's always hard to almost see like what it is, as opposed to, you know, for someone who's outside looking at it. And I'm sure I feel the same way when I look at other people who are in pop culture. And so I think that, you know, it didn't, sure, sometimes we walk down the street and someone will recognize us, but it's always funny when every other person, they stop us and they don't say, oh, were you guys like portrayed in that movie or The Social Network? It's, are you guys twins? And they're not even thinking about us for the
social.
Yeah,
they probably put it on like social media and the friend points it out to them like an hour later. Yeah, hey, do you know who that was? What do you mean?
That's happened before too. And growing up as twins, you stick out a little bit because there's two of you and we were tall. And you know, people have been stopping us like all our whole lives and being like, oh, are you twins? Like, who's old? And then the next question is always, who's older?
And then the question after that is, you must get asked that a lot.
And we're like, never. You're the first person. Yeah. So whether this all happened or not, we're always going to be like asked, are you guys twins? Like, oh, that's so cool. How old are you? Or who's older? And so, and you know, look, some people could have used this to launch a certain their career in a certain way, you know, become the next big reality TV star, you know, be a pop culture person and sell pop culture goods. We didn't want to take that path. We've certainly you know, we have somewhat of a brand. We built a brand as investors and entrepreneurs, but we took a much different path, and we understand from our athletic career that all of this stuff it's great and all, but it doesn't really help you build your company. It doesn't help you row your boat faster. So take it for what it is and understand that it's a lot of it's noise. It's it's pretty intangible, and it's not directly really related to you building something great or doing something great. And so we know what it's worth, and it's really not worth that much to our day-to-day and leading our team at Gemini of, you know, now 40 people and growing very quickly. And so we don't ever confuse it for anything it's not.
Got it. So I'm sure you hate these questions, but I have to ask them because listeners would hate me if I didn't. We'll just jump through a few questions about the movie and Facebook and whatnot. Did you see the movie before it was out? Where were you guys when you watched it? What did you think of it? What did you think to see yourself portrayed in those jokes and things like that? Was that difficult? Was it funny?
So we previewed it. I think we saw it, probably previewed it at Sony pre-release and then saw it. I think we went to, the premiere in New York, which was at,
Lincoln Center.
Lincoln Center. At the New York Film Festival in September. And at that point, the buzz had sort of started building around the movie. And I think that Sony realized that they had a real, not only like a popular movie, but a critically acclaimed movie on their hands. And you know, look, we enjoyed the film. We think it's a great piece of art. And it probably should have won Best Picture, but that's a different story. But
it almost did.
Yeah, it got certainly very close and won a lot of Oscars for other parts such as the screenplay and whatnot. But look, we enjoyed it. I think we're probably the only people portrayed in it that actually went to see it. And I think that the characters are certainly, they're not us. I think most of our friends who have seen it, they're like, yeah, it's not really you guys, but there's a story that's trying to be told, and they chose to tell it in a certain way. And it certainly created a lot of like discourse and discussion around the whole, not only our particular issue, but I think technology in general, which I think is positive.
But most importantly, it just made entrepreneurship and startups exciting. And when we were at Harvard and we were there from 2000 to 2004, computer science was pretty much a dead major. Nobody took it. Nobody talked about it. It was just not
except like
popular.
Losers like Mark Zuckerberg.
Well, those are your words. But
joking.
I actually wish I wish I had more time to do it. I would have studied comp sci, but I didn't think I could do it well with all of the rigor of rowing practices. But and then we went back to Harvard in about 2012 and talked to some students there, and computer science was the most popular major. And we sort of joke that, you know, the best recruiter for naval aviation was the movie Top Gun. And it wasn't anything else or any other like of those ads you see on TV. And we sort of joke that like The Social Network was like the Top Gun for startups and entrepreneurship. So I think there is a lot of good that came out of it. Like Cameron said, we didn't look at the movie and say, oh my gosh, that's up there. That's us up there on the screen. You got to come with the framework of this is a piece of entertainment. It's a movie. If you come in thinking like you're going to see a documentary or that it's trying to be a documentary, then you've got it all wrong. And so we really accepted it for what the medium it was and never like asked it to do more than just be interesting, kind of like inspired by a real set of events, but a great story that leaves people that when people leave the theater, the conversation has just begun. The brilliance of it is that you can take anyone's side. You can take our side. You can take Mark's side. You can take Eduardo's side. You can see everybody's point of view. It's very like Rashomon, the Akira Kurosawa film where there's a crime and you sort of see truth from different points of view and you realize that you know, truth and reality is very much your perception of it and everyone's got a little bit different one. So we kind of came in with that lens to it and never took it too seriously or got so much like, oh my gosh, this happened or this didn't, because that's not what it's trying to be.
Did you, I look at Facebook today and it's 2.25 billion people, which is a quarter of the planet. Did you ever imagine in any way, shape or form that even like when you know, after the movie or anything like that, that it would ever be this big and impactful?
If I say yes, you probably won't believe me.
But did you? I mean, was that a thought?
I don't think anyone... So I don't think any one of us would have credibly said there in the beginning, you know, when myself, Cameron, Divya, and Mark sitting in Kirkland dining room, the conversation wasn't like, this could be, you know, 2.5 billion users. I don't think the Google guys sat around and said, I don't think Sergey and Larry were like, you know, Google could become what it is today. You're focused on making something big in your local, you know, whether it's your university or in your sphere of academia or whatever. And then it can have scalability beyond that. But we didn't walk into a boathouse on day one and say, oh, I'm going to be an Olympian. I know exactly. That's exactly what I'm going to do. In 10 years, I'll be at the starting line in Beijing Olympics. At least me personally, you walk in, you say, that's interesting. I wonder what it takes to get better at it. I wonder if I can be a good high school rower. And then you do that and you go to college and you're like, I wonder if I have what it takes to become a varsity college athlete. And then when you get to graduation year, you say, I wonder if I can keep going and I feel like I can keep getting better. Maybe I should throw my hat into the ring and try the national team and go for the Olympics. So, I mean, on day one, you can fantasize, like, you know, the Olympics is, I guess, a possibility, you know, down the road for someone who succeeds for many years. But you don't, you have to focus on the stroke in front of you. That's what's important and getting better each day. And then all of a sudden you look back and all of a sudden it was that kid, the high school kid who walked into a boathouse is on the starting line of the Olympic Games. So I think that startups are like that somewhere. You know, there's potential, you don't fixate on, oh my God, like we're building to this, you know, billion user based company. I'm sure he's been on record saying he did not see that completely.
Do you, either of you, look back at that and wish that you would have been able to stay involved because of the impact it's had? Or is it just kind of a chapter that's gone by and it's like, okay, that is what it is?
So I think that if you look at the core of the Facebook and the impact of the company as a whole, at its core, it's a social network. It has been a social network from day one. And I think that the early piece in our early involvement of that, really the 3 months where, you know, the genesis of, hey, people's emails are now their identity. They're now at a point where they're willing to share their identities online. And there's a social network that starts at a university level and can sort of scale and build out beyond that. That started at the beginning, and that core concept really hasn't changed. In terms of our involvement with the company, in many ways, it allowed us to take this detour into rowing for another 10 years and go to the Olympics, which was an experience of a lifetime, something that I personally, and I don't think either one of us would trade or not have. So that's sort of one of the really interesting silver linings of this whole thing, is that we got to pursue our athletic dreams probably a lot longer than if we had stayed involved with the company and pursued that in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and I think we're fortunate enough to, we think what we're working on today has as much potential. We think that the cryptocurrency space, Bitcoin, Ethereum, these ideas are so big. They can potentially re-architect the entire internet as we know it. And we feel really fortunate to be working in this space. I think that Facebook has had a tremendous impact, but that has been pretty much in a large part realized. And there's a lot more impact to be made, and there's a lot of potential, probably greater strides to be made in different areas. And I think that digital currency is that area globally. I think the potential to actually change life, in a nutshell, it is the ultimate social network in a way. Money is the ultimate social network. And so, sure, connecting with people and sharing pictures is really important, but also connecting the world economically and financially might actually be more important. And so we are super excited to be doing what we're doing now and helping shape that future.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Here's what we're going to do right now. We're going to go to harrys.com/thehive, and we're going to check out the deal that our sponsor, Harry's, is offering our listener today. I should tell you that I've become an avid fan of Harry's razors. They're so clean and beautifully designed. They're like the Apple of razors, but without the prices, which is, of course, one of the many things that makes Harry's so amazing. The razors feel incredible. The foam gel smells so fantastic, I actually contemplated eating some the other day. And best of all, when you go to harrys.com/thehive, you get all of this for free. That's because Harry's is offering listeners of this podcast a free trial set of their razors at harrys.com/thehive. What does that even mean? Well, as I look at the website, it's a $13 value, completely for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping. The kit you'll get in the mail includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision engineered blades with lubricated strip, that scrumptious, yummy, tasty lathering gel I mentioned before, and a travel blade cover. Once again, just go to harrys.com/thehive to get your free $13 kit today. You'll absolutely love it as much as I do, I promise you. Are you guys involved in any of the other entrepreneurial things right now, or is it just, are you just focused on the Bitcoin stuff?
So we started Gemini. Gemini.com is our Bitcoin and Ether exchange. We're headquartered in New York, and we started that. We started building that about 3 years ago and putting together the initial team. We didn't launch until October of 2015 because it took us a year and a half to get our trust license from the New York Department of Financial Services. So we are a trust company, basically a bank-like organization. And we've been building that for the better part of the past 3 years. And so when we first left Rowing in 2012, we weren't sure exactly. We always knew we kind of wanted to build something and start something again, but we didn't have an immediate idea or thought right then and there. So we said, you know, why don't we try investing in a bunch of different companies, meet lots of entrepreneurs, see lots of ideas, kind of get a big scan of the environment and what's going on. And then as we got more and more into Bitcoin and then decided to say, hey, let's build a piece of infrastructure in this ecosystem, we've slowly migrated our time to now where we're probably 100% Gemini for the most part, though we still do venture investing, but on a less intensive scale, at least for our schedules. We brought on a partner to help us with that.
Right. So we are investors through our fund, Winklevoss Capital. And then, as Cameron mentioned, we were always, in some ways, that was a way to become entrepreneurs again, but just to understand and identify what that would be. And as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, we discovered Bitcoin on a beach in Ibiza and started buying it and learning about it. And then what became this really cool, you know, thing started sucking us in, and now is everything. It's everything we do all day. And we have a team that helps us run Winklevoss Capital and still do angel investments in tech companies. But we've very much shifted from investors to entrepreneurs these days.
What was the price of a Bitcoin when you first bought it?
It was in the single digits dollars, so something like $7 or $8 a Bitcoin.
And today it's around 2,500 a Bitcoin.
That's correct.
And do you buy other currencies too, like Ethereum and other things, or Ripple and all those other ones, or is it mainly Bitcoin focused?
We have invested a material amount in Ether a few years back. So Bitcoin and Ether we're the most bullish about those two. There's definitely some really interesting other stuff, projects out there, and also projects coming in the future. We're always looking, but right now Bitcoin and Ether capture about 90% of the entire market cap of every single cryptocurrency in existence. So those are really the big two. But there very well be other substantial large ones down the road. So we'll just keep having an eye out. Again, also, Gemini is very much a picks and shovels infrastructure company. It's not wedded to whether Bitcoin succeeds or not, or Ether. We personally are invested, but Gemini it's a digital asset exchange. So, you know, it's more of, it's kind of like betting on the racetrack and like not really trying to pick a horse. And if Bitcoin succeeds, great. But really it's we can support the buying and selling and storing of many cryptocurrencies.
All right, so just a last couple of questions and then we'll let you go. One question I have is, if you could imagine, you know, what you just were talking about how you think Bitcoin and all these things are going to change the way the world works more so than social media or anything has. If you could imagine what the world looks like 10 years from now, what do you think it's like? What's a day in the life with these kinds of technologies you've been talking about?
So you probably don't need a wallet anymore. So you can go just throw that out, put that in the garbage can. Everything's on your phone. It's probably pretty obvious. But I think the thing that cryptocurrencies enable are transactions that the current financial legacy system cannot support or contemplate. So if you're picked up by your self-driving car, you can't pay the self-driving cars can't get bank accounts at Wells Fargo. They could plug into protocols.
They actually might be able to get bank accounts at Wells Fargo. Maybe not JP Morgan.
But overall, they'll plug into protocols and they can actually, so you can get into that car. You can obviously pay it with cryptocurrency, but that car can also pay other cars potentially to move out of the way and in case you're in a rush. It can obviously pay for space on the road. It can pay for speed. And certainly the IoT and the sort of the all of these interconnected things now have a way to transact computer to computer, machine to machine. So if it doesn't take a lot of imagination to recognize like, wow, if these transactions, which before took like hours or days, now happen almost instantly, and micropayments, things, fractions of pennies can be actually be transacted, that opens up a whole new vista of trade. You can't send a micropayment over the internet, and outside of 8 or 10 larger, more established countries, even things like credit cards don't work.
But what do you do with what am I going to buy with a fraction of a penny as a micropayment? What is that going to afford me?
Well, it may be something like we said, you can buy certain things like road space or transact with cars or buy. It's hard for me to know exactly what that is, but maybe you want to buy a digital good from someone that doesn't really cost a fraction of a penny.
But I would just add that a microtransaction, by definition and by Visa's definition, is $17 or less. Sending a quarter through the internet is not feasible with the current infrastructure. So, right. For example, I might be willing to pay 25 cents to listen to this podcast.
A fraction of a penny.
Or a fraction. probably 25 cents. But
come on, guys, at least $17.
But we can't do that without sort of pricing it in a way. Well, if you here's $17 and you get, 10 free podcast subscriptions, you can't really break it down into an a la carte system. And in other parts of the world where that 25 cents, is much more material, you can't get that type of aid out there. For example, disaster relief or whatever it might be. So, I mean, if you think of there's billions of people who are connected. They have some form of an internet connection, whether it's a smartphone or some kind of connectivity, and are not actually in the financial system. They don't have a bank account and they have no means to actually open a bank account. But with connectivity and digital assets, and it may not be Bitcoin necessarily in 10 years, it may not be Ether, it might be something else. But with the ability to have a mobile wallet that holds digital assets on your phone, we've all of a sudden created an ability for billions more people to be connected and included in the financial system. And if you look at like most of the, credit cards are only in a fraction of the countries in the world. And in our day-to-day life, we're not waking up in the middle of the night and saying, gee, I really wish I had a better way to buy that cup of coffee. The impact of Bitcoin and these assets in our world maybe have a different impact in the sense than what they have in the developing world. And I think that if you look at the internet, it's sort of ironic. We have all this connectivity, people are connected, and yet the infrastructure of payments and banking, we haven't figured that part out.
The joke is the fastest way to get money from New York to London is actually jump on a plane with a bag of cash. Because if you send out a wire on Friday and there's a bank holiday on Monday, it's probably getting there on Wednesday. Imagine if your email shut down over the weekend, you know, or it was only open from 9 to 5. Now, we might get some sanity back, but nobody would kind of expect that. But also back to the fraction, the why that might be important is that digital currencies and these protocols might change the way companies or networks even look. So there are people who talk about, let's say, you know a lot about Twitter. I know you wrote a book on the matter, and I'm sure it was a bestseller.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It didn't require a micro payment.
Yeah, I'm plugging you on your own show.
appreciate it.
You're welcome. But people talk about building a decentralized Twitter where it's not just owned by a few people and all the data is siloed and sits on top of the internet protocols, but actually the network's owned by the people who use it. And so if you were someone who used Twitter a lot and did a lot of tweets, you would get paid in Twitter coin. And you would accumulate or accrue value based on how much you use the service, how much people liked your content. And all of a sudden, the value is accruing to the people who buy in and use the network, and not just to a few people who own the network in the traditional model. And I think that is very interesting. And that's very much the movement with these decentralized protocols is that right now the internet is basically owned by five companies. You've got Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and maybe one or two others that sit on top of it. And it's very much a centralized situation, whereas the internet was always imagined to be a peer-to-peer network. Now with the invention of these protocols, which people refer to as FAT protocols, the value is actually accruing at the protocol layer. So the internet protocols of TCP/IP, there's no value, there's no token there. But in the networks of Bitcoin and Ethereum, the value actually accrues to the people who buy into the networks, who buy Bitcoin, who buy Ether. It's very hard to extract value at the application layer, which is completely opposite of the way the current landscape is today. So with these tokens comes all of these possibilities, like, you know, paying a Twitter power user for actually the value, as opposed to right now, all you get is the service for free. And the idea is that you should get potentially more if you use it more, and it shouldn't just go to the hands of a few people.
So I think the TLDR there is that in the developing world, it's very likely that the implications have huge impact on financial inclusion into the financial system, which currently doesn't exist or not in a great way. And then I think probably for the internet and sort of the developed world, it the implications are potentially on how, you know, re-architecting the network where your data is not just owned in like five big silos on the internet where all the value accrues to the company. But potentially, you take ownership of your data, and it's in a much more decentralized fashion. Right now, the way the internet's basically set up is these silos own your data, and when you have to go and sort of say who you are, identify yourself, you have to give all your information over, and you have no real control of that. And it gets even worse when people follow you around the internet and show you ads based on the data that you had to give for free, and it's sort of all backwards. And I think people are going to have, you know, privacy is going to be re-architected quite a bit.
So I have one last question, which is a question I ask everyone on the show.
Uh-oh.
And what's that?
I said, uh-oh.
It's usually, you guys are, how old are you? You're both in your mid-30s, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. The question is usually, if you could go back in time 20 years and give your younger self some advice, what would it be? But since you're in your mid-30s, let's do 10 years. So if you could go back in time 10 years and give yourself some advice, what would it be?
Mm.
Don't all speak up at once.
Yeah. That's a great question. I mean, I think importantly, when I've thought about that question before, and not that long ago before, there aren't huge regrets that I have. And I don't want to speak for Cameron here, but I'm very happy with the choices I've made and the things we've done and how we've done them. There's always room for improvement. There's always things that, you know, that we can learn from, mistakes or whatnot. But there isn't this huge, oh, you should have like quit rowing at, you know, much earlier, or you should have, you know, lived abroad for a couple of years and, you know, moved and done the Peace Corps or something. There isn't that like huge, like, should have kind of done thing. But I think just in general, it would probably be the same things I tell myself now, which are, you know, be happy, have fun, you know, always have fun doing what you're doing. Don't worry too much kind of thing. Have perspective, understand what's important. Like we talked about relationships before and teamwork, and recognize, you know, as the older you get, that, that little like fight that you had or were about to have is just meaningless. We don't have, a lot of time on this earth. It's the only thing we have is time. You know, if we think we have money, we actually ultimately have time, because you're not taking your money with you when you no longer have time and you're no longer here. So I think those are huge things. Sort of be present. That is like the key, right, to happiness. If you sort of look at the Eastern philosophies, and it's very easy to not be in the moment, especially with the social media we live with in the worlds and the connected worlds we live today. Yes. And I'm sure we're probably part to blame for that. But I think, like being happy, always doing things like we sort of joke about, you know, it should be like a very positive feeling about everything you do. I don't know. I'm doing all the talking here, so maybe Cameron has some more advice.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I agree that a lot of the things that I focus on today, I wish I'd probably continued to focus on earlier, and building in like non-negotiable time for your passion and hobbies. So we were talking about earlier how Tyler's gotten back into we both played piano growing up, but Tyler's recently gotten back into it. And I've gotten back into the guitar after a couple of years sort of off. And I remember getting this contact for the guitar teacher that I'm currently working with, and I sat on it for a year. And then one day I was like, this, like, I actually have the time.
In the mentality of sitting on it, it's like, oh, I'm going to wait for the right time when everything's perfect or to do it. And we just convince ourselves that we have to procrastinate.
Yeah, and that we don't have the time. And then I sort of said, wait a second, of course you have the time. You can do an hour a week, and you can practice 30 to 60 minutes a day, which I don't really do, but I try to do. That's at least the goal. And then I finally just moved on it. And a year in, it's a huge passion for me, and Tyler's picked up the piano again, and creating sort of those non-negotiable things. More recently, I have turned off all the push notifications on apps on my phone, and it is such a different experience. I no longer have the phone constantly like sucking me in. And so I'd say probably I was, if anything, too connected over the past 10 years. And
I've actually done the same exact thing.
It is incredibly liberating. And now I go into the phone when on my terms, on my time, when I'm willing and ready to do it, as opposed to it constantly sucking me in and pulling me in and creating. And you get competitive with those little red circles. You're like, oh, I've got to clear out my email, got to clear out all these alerts. And then like an hour later, they're all back. And so those types of things, of like disconnecting better, batching work, and really focusing on the critical few things of like what is critical to what I'm doing.
Right.
And look, I think historically that's been probably one of our biggest strengths, is back in high school saying, look, I really want to make the junior national team in rowing, and that's all I really care about. And I'm going to do everything I can do until I hit that mark, and then picking the next mark, which is I'm going to make the varsity rowing team at Harvard. And not only am I going to make it, but I really want to win a national championship. And everything goes towards that. Every single minute of the day is going towards that. So I think historically we've been pretty good at like prioritizing. But as you get older, like life gets, you know, you get more. I mean, we're in 65 companies, investing in 65 companies. We have 40 people working at Gemini. We're more busy than we ever have been. And yet I'm finding more and more time for myself to like focus on like building skills and hobbies and passions. So I'd say if I could have started that earlier and kind of continue to build in that non-negotiable time and those habits, that's probably what I'd say to myself.
I think that I would completely agree with you. I will add one thing that I, after having this conversation with you, that I would have done differently a few years ago is I probably would have tried to invest in Bitcoin when it was at like a penny. And then I'd be off living on a beach in Ibiza somewhere. Well, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really appreciate it. Good luck with Gemini and all of your other pursuits.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having
us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
A lot of fun.
Yep. Thank you to my guests, Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Digital Media for their production work and my editors at Vanity Fair. And thanks, of course, to my sponsor, Harry's. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I'll see you next week.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We got to show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.